space.
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 Space. The final frontier.
It's amazing how four little words out of a Gene Roddenberry TV show has inspired generations to imagine what the future of space exploration will look like, and how in that time, science and fiction work together. From 1955 to 1969, we went from orbiting the Earth to landing on the moon. But since then, the race to the moon has kind of slowed down. And really, space became more about the International Space Station than really space exploration. But now in 2024, maybe, just maybe, we've hit a new ignition sequence on a new space race. And with it, a whole new level of science fiction becoming science fact with future engineering. Some of that engineering we might even find on our wrist, right back here in the Watch Fam.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm your host, AJ Barce, and you've tuned into the Analog Explorer podcast. Read about my analog manifesto, my passion for photography, and my love of travel, diving, and watches in print and online at analogexplorer.com. Now, you may have already noticed the tone of this episode's already a little bit 8-bit and different, and that's because I've reinvited an Analog Explorer alum, Karel Bachand of Barrelhand Watches. We're going to talk about space engineering, a space watch that's coming this summer, and revisit his thoughts on why he thinks watches are the best platform for engineering exploration.
It's a really good platform for innovation. Here's something that's really small, needs to be ultra precise. I would argue it's like the holy grail of tolerances and precision. The learnings from Project One, we basically want to carry over everything that we put into Project One and learned from Project One and put it into the next chapter, I would say. And it's called Monolith.
So today's conversation is around Monolith, but also what it takes to be a mechanical explorer in today's digital age as we reach back to the stars. Because you may have noticed, we're back on the moon! Kind of lopsided, but Barrelhand had a hand on one of the payloads on that very lunar lander, an out-of-this-world memory disk that also will be gracing the case back of their new watch. But that lunar lander is a lot like Monolith. It's the first of future platforms for science, technology, engineering, and exploration. And it's that notion that carries over into the ethos that makes the Monolith. It's not just a watch, it's not just a bunch of engineering, but looking at what it takes for humans to go up into space and the technologies that we're gonna need to achieve it. And what better way to explore it than to make the next generation of space watch that was built for space, but this time made from the ground up.
Ignition sequence start.
We're on the moon.
Oh, really? Really? That's all you're going to give me is we're on the moon. Let's go.
Let's go.
Karel.
No, dude. I'm super happy to be here. It's a super exciting time. Not just for us, but for space history too.
Right. Okay. So let's rewind. Okay. So we're recording this on February 23rd, Friday. Okay. Yep. Yesterday, touchdown around, because there was a bit of moving the goalpost there, but I think touchdown was just before 3 o'clock ish. Pacific time, our time.
Yeah, right around there.
So, in the last year, Karel, have you been working on anything? I mean, last we chatted, we were talking about 3D printing and a watch. What you been doing, bro?
Yeah, we're making a tool watch for astronauts, so professional grade tool watch, and we're doing like all the EVA certifications that were initially outlined during the Apollo mission and trying to do a next gen version.
In doing so, in the last year, you and I have been chatting, and you even sent me a prototype of Monolith that I got to beat up, take on trails. I didn't get it diving. Yeah. That was the one thing, the timing of it. But speaking of timing, this lunar lander, what did Barrelhand have a hand in?
We're working with this technology company called Stamper Technology, and they do nanofiche, which is a type of nano engraving. We were incorporating it into the watch to build what we were calling the memory disk. And as we were developing prototypes and figuring out like the content for it and everything, he was like, oh, by the way, we're gonna be putting a plaque on one of the new moon missions coming up with Intuitive Machines. Do you want to be a part of it? And I was like, okay, yeah. That yes. Sounds like
the answer is always yes.
Yeah. So obviously there was a lot of logistics in between to get that finalized and approved. But in the end, we basically got to curate together a kind of like Voyager Disk 2.0, if you will, just creating a bunch of content and trying to figure out what that content would even be, and then nano engraving it onto this plaque to put towards the moon.
Now, how big is the plaque that is on the moon lander?
So the actual plaque, I think, is 180 millimeters. I'd have to double check. It's bigger than the one that's on the watch.
So it's about the size of a plate, like a little legitimate, like
plate. It's like a dinner plate. Yeah, roughly.
Now, and that has to describe, and we'll have links in the show notes, and we'll have images and such. But like, this is if you're of a certain age demographic that I am, you may have remembered going back to your library days, and you would sit down and you would go through the archives on microfiche, where they were like these little things of like film, and you would have this super cool magnifier, and you go through, and that's how you'd read newspapers from the 1930s, and back. This is that on steroids, right? Like this is
next level. I mean, just as like a fan of technology, when I first heard about it, I thought it was super cool, and I just wanted to like figure out what the limits of it were. And as we were testing it and figuring out the resolution, I mean, the scale at which you can do it is insane. It's like in the nanometer range of resolution, where you could just like engrave on the scale of books. You could put like thousands of pages on something the size of a quarter, for example.
Yeah, as opposed to like microfiche, if you might remember, like, you know, you have like basically like a reel, and like you would go back and forth and such. And it was about the width of, my memory is fading in my, you know, fourth decade here, but about the size of like a slide that you would put underneath a microscope, right? Now, and this is just me trying to depict like translating this into the back of the watch here. Your case back has roughly the size of a nickel. It's a little bit smaller than a quarter, bigger than a nickel. And on that disc, that's really cool. Like, it speaks to my 80s kids vibe, because like it looks like a hologram, right?
Yeah.
If you were to take that under a microscope, and I did, you would see a whole bunch of data that is imagery from around the world. And it's roughly about, what, five gigabytes of data that's visual on there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
On the size of a nickel.
Yeah, it's wild. It's really cool technology. And what I love too is that it's like reverse readable. So I think when we think of like data preservation, you look at like a hard drive or like Google Drive, we just feel like that's going to last forever somehow, even though like 5-10 years from now, your hard drive is probably going to be shit. And then the Google Drive, like, I don't know, who knows?
Right.
But basically, having something that is just nano engraved, it's almost like hieroglyphs, but like a future generation of hieroglyphs, where I mean, it'll last a million years on the moon. If it doesn't, I don't know what could really erode it at this point, because it's not going to oxidize. It doesn't have a half-life. Nickel is like super stable, the metal that we engrave into. So it's just like a super resilient technology that even a million years from now, when we have some new type of data storage, they're still able to easily reverse read what's on there, because it's just optics. It's just like you zoom in with a magnifier of some sort, really like simple technology, as opposed to like encrypted data where you have to, I don't know, unencrypt it or have the drivers necessary to read it. It's like very simple and robust and future-proof in that way.
So when you say it's reverse readable, like when I saw it, because I did, I took the prototype, I put it underneath, because I'm a nerd and an academic, I happen to have a microscope here at the house, and I put it underneath, and you know, it's a holographic and stuff. And when I zoomed in, like I could see a lot. Like, you have some historical frescoes on there, like the Sistine Chapel and stuff. And I mean, it is high res under a microscope. Is it monochromatic, or is it actually colored data that's also preserved there as well?
It's all grayscale, black and white. Okay. So basically what it's doing is it's either like etching in or not etching in, and that's creating whites and blacks depending on like how the light hits it. It just creates a sense of kind of grayscale. So it would be really cool to do color one day. What I like is you look at it and it looks like full color.
Right.
I mean, when I first saw this technology, like I saw it online, I was like, okay, that's pretty cool, but I wonder how it is in person. And then we got the first samples, and it was like straight out of like a Star Wars, like data center, you like the way the light hits, it's like these rainbow refractions that kind of hit the lines a certain way. It looks like a hologram, and it's just like this solid state data storage. It's insanely cool. It feels like we're living in the future.
It is. Like, that was the first thing that I noticed, is like, I knew that the light was playing with me, because like any hologram, like I remember sitting at my breakfast dinner table as a kid, as a 7-year-old, and I would be eating my box of, you know, Cocoa Krispies or whatever. And I remember the days where on the cardboard box, there would be like little bonuses and stuff. And so there was a hologram of like dinosaurs, and you know, you take it and you tip it to the light and all these rainbow of colors would go. What's interesting about the memory disk is there's so much detail in the data of the black and white grayscale that as the color tones rip through it, if you know what the image looks like in your head, it kind of messes with you. You're like, oh yeah, I remember
that.
Like, and that's why I was curious. So like, and this is a positive image. Like, this is not a negative, like a film negative. Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, yeah.
Okay. So now that we've nerded out hardcore about the memory disk, what was the mission, and what other, like, because there was a lot of other payloads. Like, you weren't the only person on this. Do you want to talk a little bit about the mission, the rocket mission?
Just as like a space enthusiast, I was following this mission even before we found out we were potentially going to be a part of it. I actually went to Florida to watch it live on the launch last week, and watched it take off from Cape Canaveral Launch Pad 39A, which is like historical Apollo launch site where all those Apollo missions were happening. So just being there on site and seeing the place for the first time was really cool. And then seeing a SpaceX Falcon 9 with a lunar lander on top, and knowing that one of our payloads was on this thing, was just, I mean, my head was exploding. I was tearing up. It was really cool. And then it basically takes off, you see it go out into the distance, and you're trying to process that, like, something you built is also a part of this mission. I've seen a few other rocket launches here in California, because we have Vandenberg Air Force Base, and just seeing a rocket launch, I recommend to anyone. It's really moving and powerful. You're seeing them land now, which is incredible. So anyways, we see this payload go off, and it's heading towards the moon, and eventually it's just like this tiny little dot in the distance, because it was a nighttime launch. And next thing we knew, it was on its way towards the moon. So we had just been following it. And the core mission, I would say, of what Intuitive Machines is doing with this is they're doing commercial payloads. They're doing payloads for NASA with the idea of developing a viable, like, lunar lander that basically people can pay to play and put research vehicles on and start to map out the lunar surface for future missions to the moon. So NASA's interest in this, they did, I think it's called the CLIPS program. And basically what that is they put a couple of their own payloads aboard this modular lunar lander, you could say, because they want to study the lunar surface for their Artemis program that is coming up soon. So you could say that this success of the first private company to touch down on the moon is the foundation of the next chapter of space exploration. It's the foundation of the Artemis program. It's the foundation for us setting up a moon base in the next couple of years. So it's just, I think right now, even I feel the news is not fully conveying the scope of it. There's just like so much noise these days that even us landing on the moon now seems to be like very blasé, and people kind of like move on to the next thing. But if you really stop to think about what this mission represents, we're embarking on the next chapter of space exploration. This is the beginning of the journey where we're going to have like people on the moon full time year round and seeing the next generation of Artemis program.
Right. But let's take a step back and take a look at what we have achieved. And that is, you know, so the lander landed. Granted, we find out later that it landed a little tipsy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, your disc, as well as the other payloads on the moon lander, landed. So what's the end game? Like, now that you have this nano engraved disc, which also a smaller version of it is on the back of the monolith, like, what was your mission as Barrel Hand, other than to use this new technology in the creation of the monolith? Like, what was your engineering mission or science around doing this?
So it was for two reasons. One, we do want to like understand like a longevity study. Eventually someone will be able to touch down and look further at the degradation of these disks, but in theory it's supposed to last a million years plus. So on one hand, it's kind of like, checking the hardware, but what we really wanted to do is preserve this data on the moon and create a connection to home. And I think that's something that is often overlooked in space exploration, as we get really focused on the technology and the specs and just meeting all the technical requirements, which of course you have to do. If you want to go to space, you need to meet the technical requirements. But then there's also like a human component of space exploration that most engineers working on these things just kind of like skip over because like the emotions, the feelings, we'll deal with that later. But psychology in space is a serious thing, and there's a lot of like psychology that has to be processed when you're in a closed environment for months or years at a time away from everything you've ever known. It can be very existential, and we kind of expect these people to just somehow be very stoic and deal with it. So what we wanted to do with the memory disk that we put up on the moon is to create this connection to home, and we wanted to curate content from around the world that would create this feeling, this connection, and then place it on the moon, and then also have a carbon copy of that on a watch that an astronaut can wear.
Gotcha.
And what you put on there is a whole nother story. It's like, okay, great, you want to create a connection to home. What does that look like? How do you make a universal connection? That sort of thing. So it's not like it took us a while to figure out what we even wanted to put on there, what's worth preserving, what feels timeless or what feels cross-cultural, that sort of thing. It was a really fun thought experiment. And I hope that other people, as they're kind of like learning about the memory disk, there's so much to unpack on it that it's not like an immediate like, I get it. It's just cool. And I think it can be interpreted in many ways. And it makes you think differently of like what space exploration is beyond just the technical, but kind of what it means for us as a society.
You and I've had a lot of conversations over the last year, and it's kind of clear to me, but like I kind of want to get it from the founder's mouth. Barrelhand is not just a watch company, is it?
We started out, you could say, Project One, and we were like, oh, you know, the principle was to create this watch, but I think really the foundation, without knowing it at the time, was I was using Project One as a platform for innovation, and just I wanted to test out all the new technologies, set up like a manufacturing infrastructure. And during the development, I realized it was more than just the watches that got me into this. It was the engineering behind it, the opportunity for innovation, and the fact that watches are a really cool platform to test these new technologies, because everything's so precise, so small, and so intricate that it really is a good test bed for like proof of concept on new tech to see if it can be implemented. And I think that lends itself into Monolith now, where it's also a watch, but it's more about the technology behind it and making something that's purpose-driven, as opposed to just maybe more like a decorative watch or a watch designed, inspired by space. It's like we really wanted to take all the learnings from Project One and apply it to a real-world challenge. And to us, the next chapter of space exploration is like the harshest conditions we've ever known, and we haven't really figured out proper solutions for this yet. No one's really designed a full-fledged watch for space exploration. There's been stuff that's passed these tests that were set out in the 60s, mm-hmm. but beyond that, there's not been a lot of innovation there, and it's a new frontier that has a lot of technical challenges, and we need tools that meet those requirements, basically.
Yeah, it is kind of funny to think that a watch that doesn't have a real depth rating went to the moon, right? Like that's the Speedmaster. But yeah. I actually pulled the NASA test from 1965. There's 11 mm-hmm. tests that the original Speedmaster, they did a high temperature test, low temperature test, vacuum test, humidity test, corrosion test, kind of dovetails into your memory disk, shock resistant test, which I will remind everybody is 40G shocks in six different directions. We'll come to that in a second with the case. An acceleration test, because obviously, you know, these rockets are going pretty ding-dong fast. Yeah. Low pressure test, high pressure test, a vibration test, because I mean, back then things were rattling, and I imagine our rockets are still as rattly as heck. And then a sound test, which I thought was interesting. So with Monolith, and I know that Monolith is basically your platform, your chassis, the test bed of innovation for what you're going to be developing in the future beyond just a time-only timepiece. Tell me a little bit, let's start with the case, because I've always been a fan of this case since you put a gag order on me and I couldn't talk about it. I love this case, but specifically, this case is not is made out of this world. It is not just steel or titanium. This is, and I might be slaughtering the name of it, it's
Scalmalloy.
Scalmalloy, that's it. Yeah, Scalmalloy. Yeah. Okay, for those of us that aren't geophysicists, what's Scalmalloy?
We first found about it through our 3D printing manufacturing partner, and they kind of like put this on the table as, hey, this is kind of like an experimental material that we're looking for like beta testers on. They're using it in some applications for aerospace, so I think Boeing is using it, or Airbus, and people are building like satellites using this material, but no one's ever like done a consumer or like commercial kind of product with it. So there was a lot of testing involved to make that happen. But basically, Scalmalloy is a scandium magnesium aluminum alloy, and it's essentially, it's almost the same weight as aluminum, but it's the strength of titanium, which is like crazy. So you, to frame it differently, you could say it's almost half the weight of titanium and twice the strength of aluminum. But it's just, I mean, it feels like science fiction. And when you handle it, it's insanely light. I think the new chassis prototypes that are like 20% lighter than the one you had that you were beta testing. I think we're down to like 9 grams for the chassis, and then the total watch I think is right around 1 ounce right now. So we're not like going for that metric specifically of like, oh, we need to make the lightest watch, because that's defeating the purpose of like, we need to make a rugged tool watch that meets the actual criteria. But part of the thinking was the cost per kilogram to send to space is around 20,000 US. So any gram we can shave off is also a win. In terms of impact resistance, so having something lightweight, it's like the inertial impact is also like, it's just reduces the amount of energy that kind of like transfers through into the movement. So there's also other benefits to being lightweight, but the whole thing is right around 1 ounce. And the idea of using Scalmalloy is what also is a huge part of what makes that weight like possible.
Carell, okay, so I'm gonna rewind as a beta tester. So when I had this for a couple of weeks, this was the light. I own a titanium watch. I have a titanium Aries Diver One, made right just south of me in Stanwood, Washington. Okay, he announced it on my show, and I thought it was cool because it was a light. It's a big watch. Okay, and it's lighter than say like an SKX 007 that's made in steel. Cool. Then you sent me the monolith, and I put it on my wrist. It's lighter than my resin marathon watch that's military issued with a hand-wind movement in it. Okay?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's what's bonkers is, like, it. I mean, I asked you if I had to baby this, and you're like, no, please don't. So, like, you know, I'm thrashing it with my son on trails, you know, and I'm rubbing it again. Like, and what's crazy is, there's this moment where I'm like, God, I feel like I'm going to blow in its screw in bars. So, I mean, there's no spring bars, which was nice. I mean, they do screw in, which was cool. Yeah. But like, I almost felt like, because at least on the prototype, I'm going to probably break the bar.
The screw tubes, yeah.
The screw tubes before I'm going to break the case. But it feels so dainty.
It's so great.
I mean, I strapped it on my son, not gonna lie. And because awesome. I told you, like, really, if you want it beta test, you strap it on a toddler or an elementary school kid. So, you know, around trails and stuff, did not have him take it to school. Okay. But I did have him, you know, remind me, it's 38 millimeters.
Yeah, 38 millimeters and 10.9 millimeters thick.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you said it's nothing. It weighs nothing. Like, I can't express over a podcast how nothing it feels. Which leads me to ask you the question, like the engine, as it were, inside that you guys are going to be tooling it with, is it going to be ETA, Solita? Like what are you going to power with the movement?
Yeah, so the engine is, we built it off a Solita SW300-1B.
Elaborate? And,
we didn't go crazy with the finishes. We went crazy with more the specs.
Okay.
So we kind of wanted to take, it was actually an interesting exploration because there's so many movements available now. And I love reading about the specs and what also like actual watchmakers that service movements think of these different movements that are available. And I think there's often this kind of like tabooness of using like off the shelf movements.
I love them.
Yeah, exactly. And we can get into why, but you know, when you think about something in-house, it's like, it's something that's more recently developed. So the idea that it's going to be as industrial grade, as robust, as something that is, you could say, largely like mass produced on scale and has been done that for, you know, like 10, 20 years. They've continued to refine it during that 10, 20 year of development, and they've tested it over millions of watches out in the field, getting feedback. I mean, it's kind of like, in my mind, it also became like best case scenario of what kind of engine NASA would select if they were looking for a timing device. They don't want some like very artisanal, hand finished, in house movement that's small batch and made by two watchmakers, and they can only make 20 a month. It's like we explored that route genuinely because there's part of us where we thought, okay, if we're building something super high tech, we also need the current state of the art in watchmaking. And so we looked at like silicon escapements, we looked at like the flexible like compliant mechanism escapements, but that stuff is still really in the theoretical phase. It's like they're starting to release them, but they have their own issues. It's not refined yet. I really do feel like that's going to be the future, but right now it's not robust enough to warrant saying, okay, this is like space grade yet. So
interesting. Okay.
It was a fun exploration because for me, I'm like a huge like enthusiast of new technologies, and it's easy to want to adopt all the latest and greatest, but as an engineer and as someone developing a professional grade tool watch, you also have to manage that in a way where there's a duality of like, okay, there's a difference between something that's like super new and high tech versus a technology that has been tried and true and tested. And I think, you know, the old adage of keep it simple, stupid definitely applies to space exploration. So it's been a really fun design challenge to explore, you know, implementing new technologies when it makes sense, but then also being realistic with what is the best solution for this application. And as much as we want to go like the super exotic high-tech route for 3D printing a movement, for example, which we're also in tandem exploring, but it's not robust enough yet to do something like that. So we went with what I consider to be the best base engine for space exploration. It's super light. It's thin. It's been built for like the last 20 years. It's been refined, improved. There's been lots of little like small updates to make it what it is now. And this movement's been made almost like a million times and put into different watches. So there's so much feedback that it's super refined and it's industrialized. And it's the same kind of stuff that NASA would be using if they were trying to build a tool watch from scratch, in my opinion. And then what we did is we took this super solid base movement and we upgraded a bunch of things to meet the requirement without going too crazy that it became like this like super custom scaffolding that was like, it can also be risky if you overly customize. So you kind of have to find your balance. So what we worked on was mostly making it more anti-magnetic. So a lot of the escapement components now are just using different alloys and materials that make it more anti-magnetic. doing a lot of like testing and certification for them. So different ISO standards, anti-magnetic standards, shock resistance standards. So different like anti-shock systems, and basically try to make the movement as robust as possible with simple things like that. Regulation is another one that we worked on, is trying to get it as precise as possible in different positions and orientations. So you can actually like do a lot with starting off with like a really robust engine to just kind of like max it out in terms of specs.
Sure. You did the traditional American muscle car. I'm following. This is not yeah, your granny's you Mustang.
Let's go.
You know, it's got a totally throated 302 in it. I got you.
Yeah.
So with that, like obviously the thing that I noticed when I had my Aries on wrist is that the titanium is super light, but I could feel where the weight is. The crystal and the movement itself, which has mm-hmm. also an F2824 in it. I'm just curious, like, did you reduce the weight in the movement at all?
We did a little bit on the rotor, but it's kind of minimal in the grand scheme of the case weight reduction. So on the rotor, it's like you can skeletonize it so that it's basically just the rotating mass and making sure it's still sturdy. But beyond that, we kept it pretty standard and focused kind of like on the components housing it and supporting it to be as light as possible. But in the future, we're looking at how we can make the movement lighter, because that's obviously a big source of the weight. And if you can make it lighter, it's also more resistant to impacts. So the movement we have right now, the way it's set up, it's meeting, I think it's called chronifiable A8 standard. It's kind of like an ISO standard. And it's able to withstand 555 Gs of impact, just the engine itself.
Wow.
And then we have other systems outside, like an engine mount that's also amplifying that further. So we're actually going to be doing some data analysis on that to figure out how much additional impact resistance the engine mount adds.
So one of the things that's changed is the back, I'm going to call it the back hatch, patent pending. The back hatch has changed since you and I had chatted, and that is you went away from a screw mount, an actual screw threaded in door.
That's right.
To four screws. Why make that change? Why now? Granted, of course, this does have a water rating, but again, it's not meant to be a dive watch. This is a space watch. It has more of a depth rating than a certain Omega space watch. So why all of a sudden the change of just something as simple as, you know, accessing the back hatch?
We wanted to think about what it means to service in space. So it's funny, if you go on like forums for astronauts or like watch enthusiasts, there's actually a lot of like documentation of people having to service their Omega in space, because I mean, stuff breaks. It's just like the nature of it. And it got us thinking too of like, okay, what does it mean to service tools and hardware in space? It's not like you just place an order on Amazon and they'll ship it out.
Wait,
to
there's
you.
No, like, whoa. I know Bezos has rockets too. I can't get Prime 2-day shipping orbital. I don't understand. What?
Yeah, soon I'm sure it'll get there. But for now, it's like, okay, what does the ISS have available? What can they use to work on the stuff that's up on the ISS, and how do you go about like servicing something like that? So it's interesting to look at, because you realize there's obviously, it's NASA, so they have tons of standards on what kind of screws they use, what kind of tools they use. And we got into the nitty gritty. We like learned about like what kind of like torques, like drivers they use, what's currently available. And our idea was to make the watch as modular as possible and keep kind of like servicing and maintenance in mind. Because for now, you know, the ISS is like, yeah, there's resupplies every so often. But as we go further into the moon or to Mars, you're going to be even more isolated. So the idea of designing it for many, like for serviceability and maintenance, will go a long way. So we wanted to make the case back, instead of like a traditional case back where you have to like use a special tool to like unscrew it. We wanted to use Torx heads, just like simple screws to undo it. And at the same time, flatheads aren't great in space because it doesn't necessarily lock on. You kind of like
flatheads are not good on Earth.
They slip, so
they suck.
So we kind of just tried to approach it as like simply as possible in terms of like what's standard, what are they using on the ISS, and then just building the tool to kind of like meet with the tools that are available.
Inside, we've got the case back. We talked about the memory disk, the back hatch, patent pending. You can open that up using torque screws. And then inside, I'm not just going to see a Sellita movement. What type of, do you have like an elastomer, like shock absorber that's going around this? Or what other, I know you're an engineer. You had to have engineered the crap out of this. So what's the inside? Inside of the chassis before we get to the engine, what's the engine mounts?
Yeah. I can share a bit of it because we haven't like released it like in depth as an article or like a feature, but basically we looked at different shock absorption systems just to further protect the engine on the inside. But the first solution was these elastomer kind of engine mounts like you're describing, which other companies are using. They basically use something that is kind of like
squishy,
rebound squishy. Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of different materials that can do that, so you kind of balance how firm you want it to make sure it stays in place, but then also squishy enough that it resists impact. And the more we were looking into it, the more we realized that it actually might not be good for space exploration because of how hot and cold it can get. So if you're going from minus 120 C to plus 120 Celsius, that's a huge range, and there's not really any elastomer that can withstand that range very stably, and also not like expand and contract so much that now the engine is rattling in there. So we actually experimented a lot with that in the early days, where the first engine mounts we had were actually out of PEEK, like a type of plastic, but it's like a very like engineering kind of, they use it in aerospace quite commonly. And we actually tried like a 3D printed PEEK, which is really cool too, that you can do like advanced composites with 3D printing now. But after like a couple months of testing, if you can imagine this engine and like the case clamps, the way that the engine gets held to the engine mount, it would like slip and shift because it was so like spongy of a material. So it just kind of like indents over time when you smash it.
It builds a memory.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't just like return to its original shape. So then I looked at metal shock absorption systems. You might have seen MBNF, they did like this really cool their Evo series, where it's kind of like this springy kind of like
free suspension. Yeah,
really cool stuff. We looked at that, but for how small and precise we needed this travel, we also didn't want it to just travel up and down, but it also needs to withstand side to side, basically all directions of impact. So we came up with this type of system that's basically, it's aluminum engine mount that's holding the engine itself. And then there's a buffer system within that has these like silicone gaskets or O-rings basically that are sitting on the edges in the corners. And you could say like travel limiters built within the case so that the engine mount can travel at most, say like 0.3 millimeters in any direction. And this silicone O-ring is kind of working as a shock absorber. So it, no matter what direction it goes, there's kind of like this dampening effect from the silicone housed within aluminum. So it's like super sturdy. And then you have these shock absorbers that allow it to move a certain amount in any direction. And it dampens a lot of the impact on top of the engine that's like 555 Gs of impact resistance.
So really what you're telling me is, again, we're talking about space here, so there's microgravity or no gravity. The only real concern that an astronaut needs to worry about is the crystal shattering.
I mean, Hess light is commonly used right now. That's what's on the Omega. But the downside with acrylics, which is what Hess light is, it's kind of like a rebranded acrylic.
It's Kleenex. It's Kleenex of acrylic.
Yeah, exactly. that stuff scratches super easily. So I liked the idea of having something that could withstand the same like EVA certifications or IVA certifications, because you don't want glass shattering everywhere in the space station. That's pretty dangerous. So how can we meet those requirements, but also have something that's like a long-term solution to where you don't have to replace the glass because it's all scratched up, or just something that's kind of monolithic in that the material will withstand and probably outlive the person wearing it. And the solution that we started exploring, I mean, we looked at tons of stuff. There was one company that does entire slabs of diamond. So it's like an entire 2 millimeter thick, 30 millimeter wide, like lab grown diamond.
Whoa.
And it's like $30,000.
Of course.
Something.
It's like, it's
like
a diamond.
Ridiculous, obviously.
Dude, but you would have the most, like, everybody's talking about rainbow Daytonas. Dude, you would have.
You got the diamond watch.
Right. Okay. Okay. So no diamond on monolith. So what next?
Not just the cost perspective, but from the like actual material science, having something that hard is also not great, because you're looking at something that's extremely brittle too. Like diamond, it's impossible to scratch. But if you think about how brittle it is, it's very like fragile in that way. So there's kind of like this trade-off where on one hand you have acrylic where, I mean, you could smash it with the hammer and it probably won't even crack because it's able to flex so much. Then you get onto like diamond and it's so rigid that you basically, it doesn't have any flex. So if you hit it hard enough, it can shatter a bunch, even though it's hard to scratch, if that makes sense. So there's kind of like this spectrum and range. So that didn't pan out. We looked at even taking sapphire and like diamond coating it, because there's coating companies that can do diamond coatings, but it's kind of the same thing. Now you have this layer that's extremely brittle. And then we found a company that does transparent aluminum. And I think we were talking about that last time.
Let's say that again. Transparent aluminium. Yeah. How does that work?
We looked into this a lot because it seemed super promising. NASA had actually looked into it to replace the cupola windows on the ISS. So there's a lot of testing being done as kind of like this next generation glass. The more we were looking into it, we just realized like we just need to get our hands on some samples so we can test it ourselves. In person, I mean, it's cool to handle. It's like you're holding, it looks like glass. It looks like anything else. It's just, it's
clear.
It's not like any other. It just looks the same. But at the same time, how they brand it, at least, it's like transparent aluminum, which is, I think what it really is alumina oxynitride, which is a form of, it's actually more like a ceramic. It just has like aluminum powder in it that, is how it got its brand name. So we tested that out. We got like all these drop test rigs and we put a bunch of samples. We did regular sapphire and then we did transparent aluminum. And then we did another type of material that we were like optimistic about. So we're doing these drop tests and like right from the get-go, the transparent aluminum was like doing the same as like traditional sapphire, more or less. It was like, lame. I know we, and it's like we tested a bunch because we were also like really excited about it. It just seemed like cool tech, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, where, you know, it's great to put the latest and greatest new technology, but it needs to pass the test. At the end of the day, it needs to work. It's like with backpacking gear. It's like, I don't care what the marketing pitch is. If it lasts during my backpacking trip and I can beat it up for many years, then it's just a good product and that's what it is. So I think for this, there's actually really good applications for transparent aluminum because you're compressing and molding it so you can make complex shapes that you couldn't do with sapphire, of a similar strength to sapphire. So it's like a sapphire analog, but you can get more complex with geometries like domes and stuff like that. So it's definitely got a really good use case. But for us, we just needed something simple. So it wasn't a fit for our solution on monolith at the time. During the testing, we had also sampled one of the companies we work with to produce the sapphire. They do lab grade optics. So they're not like part of the watch industry. They're like, they're doing optics for like laser experiments and stuff like that. And they can produce different grain patterns of the sapphire. So traditional sapphire, they just kind of produce whatever angle of the grain structure. It's just kind of like there's no like preset orientation of like, oh, the crystal structure has to be upright, or it has to be there's different names for it. There's like C-plane sapphire, M-plane sapphire, A-plane sapphire, but you only ever see this in lab applications. When you look at watches, it's generic. They don't really put an emphasis. It's randomized more or less.
Right. Because all they're worried about is clarity enough to see a dial. Whereas in research experiments, you need to know, because if you're shooting a laser, you don't want refraction and all this other stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. So we asked our manufacturer that works in this stuff all the time, and they recommended us. They're like, okay, if you're looking for impact resistance, I would look at C-plane sapphire, because the way the crystal structure is shaped, it'll resist quite a bit better than just like a random orientation. So with that recommendation, we ordered samples and we did the same tests with transparent aluminum and the sapphire, the traditional watch sapphire. And that thing was crazy. Like we kind of got it, like, you know, just on a whim. Like we're just like, oh, we'll test it, but it's probably the same as traditional sapphires, literally what I originally thought. And then as we're doing these tests, we're like, holy shit, this is a huge opportunity. So on average, over the samples we tested, it was performing 2.5 times better than traditional sapphire in terms of like impact resistance. Crazy. So same thickness, same diameter, like everything was standardized. And then we're basically dropping a mass. We'll be sharing videos and like do a full article update on it, but you guys will get the sneak peek on it. It's crazy. I wasn't expecting it. I was like, even if it's like marginally better, great. But the fact that it's like over 2 times better than traditional sapphire, I almost didn't believe it. And so we had to do like multiple tests and we're like, yeah, it checks out. It's like consistently like over 2 times better. There was one where it did almost 3x better. There was one where it was like on the low end was like just a little under 2 times better than traditional sapphire. But like the average was just like so mind boggling. It was hard to like believe, because sapphire already is super strong. And
yeah,
I don't know of many people that have ever like broken their crystal just through daily wear. I mean, no. If you take a hammer to it, it probably will, but most of the time it's like it's a very like rare occasion, because it's already a strong material. So that's
I've bludgeoned a lot of my watch faces underwater because of a current change, or I'm up against a jetty. I mean, my Baltic has a domed sapphire crystal, and man, there was one dive I was just like, oh, that's not good, because I mean, I just smacked it across this rock by accident. Not a scratch on it. And it was just, it mind boggles me.
Yeah. Going back to the glass itself, when we found out about this, we were like, okay, well, this is a clear winner. So that's what we're
a clear winner. Wow. Really? Yeah. Did you use that pun on me? A clear winner? I'm the dad joke guy in our relationship. Come on.
So that's what we're moving forward with. The other thing that we did, because this is like a lab optics manufacturer, is we asked them what kind of like AR coatings they can do. And usually when you go to like with traditional watch sapphire, there's like a standard AR coating that's just using like multiple layers of chemicals, and it can kind of like erode over time. These guys were like, oh, like industry standard in lab optics, we do magnesium fluoride coating. So now there's like this layer of just like a solid like magnesium fluoride layer that is serves, it does the same exact thing as like traditional like AR coatings, but it's supposed to be way more resilient because it's just a single coating. There's less risk of like delamination or like flaking, that sort of thing. So that was another cool like little added spec that they helped us with, because we're not experts on this stuff, and it came from kind of like the lab optics industry, which is really cool. And then on top of that, then we used a glass like suspension mount system to further like reduce impact. And
so to pull from the Martian, you engineered the shit out of this, and you've got a crystal that has, for as far as I know, has not ever been used in a watch application. You're using a metal for a case that has never been used in any consumer grade application. You've got a movement that is the tried and true Hemi of all engines, and a memory disk that is got like 5 gigs of visual information coded in a sapphire, so it won't, you know, you're not gonna degrade the actual disk itself. The last thing I gotta ask is, because in true Barrel Hand fashion, you speak to my love of orange, the orange crown, or as you call it, the airlock. What's going on with that sitch?
I don't know if the prototype you had this feature, but basically with this crown, I always liked the idea of a tool that you could use no matter where you are or how you use it. If you think about chronographs or certain like date complications on watches, there's like, don't set it at this
danger
time.
Zone. Or
don't,
yeah.
Yeah, there's danger zones. And I always liked the idea of like tools where you don't even have to think about it. It's like,
right.
It just works no matter what. Like there's no wrong way to use it. So with the crown, I wanted to have something that was basically you could set it, wind it, crown in, crown out, even if it was underwater or right. in vacuum. And it's probably not something that you would realistically need, but it's kind of a nice to have. Just the peace of mind of like with this tool, no matter where you are, no matter how you use it, you just don't even have to think about it. It's going to work. So that's been fun to play around with. Our business partner, Michael Sorkin, also on the team, he went down and dove with it and he sent me a video, and it's like operating the crown underwater. Like I think it was like 20 meters deep,
yeah.
Which is not anything crazy, but still to be looking at a watch and seeing someone set the time underwater, it just feels so like counter to what everyone tells you, like never pop the crown out, never.
Oh, I know. If you wouldn't have given it to me, like, because I had it in December, and I'm like, I have obligations for holidays, and I got to get an extra dive in and go deep where it's also cold. I demand a redo, because like when
we'll make it happen.
Yeah, you asked me, you're just like, yeah, you mind taking this down? And I was like, oh heck yeah! And I'm like, I don't have any dives scheduled. But no, it's crazy. It's a little bit of a nod to the history of like dive watches. We look back at the Blancpain 50 Fathoms, right? It was never a screw-in crown, and you know,
yeah.
So like I found, you know, from one watch turn to another, like you engineered it to be kind of a nod to the past without the extra fiddliness in space of a screw-in crown. You know, I thought that was an interesting take.
It's cool that you said that too, because I was actually, when I was talking to Jason over at the Grenado, he had also sent me an article, or it was a document dating back to like the 50s for the Navy that was requiring, like one of their like dream specs for one of the watches was that it can be operable underwater, mm-hmm. that you could basically pop out the crown. And then now we just think of dive watches as like fully like screw down is the mm-hmm. only way to go. But I mean, with crown guards, you don't even have to worry about it popping out. It's just kind of like, yeah, now it's cool to think that you have this feature where you could play around with it even underwater.
Let's kind of wrap up some of the logistics of what's to come and what you can tell me with like pricing, availability, and the EVA part. I have not forgotten that part. You kind of said that in the beginning, and I'm just like, yeah, we're going to hold that till the end. So obviously this is a high tech with a capital H and capital T. And I'm assuming like you call it a professional. There's going to be a civvy version as well. So like, is there two different pricing? Is what's going to be the differences between the pro and the civvy version?
Same pricing. It's one-to-one the same. Mm-hmm. Basically the idea with Monolith was to build like a purpose mission-driven application or tool watch, and with Monolith everything's been going towards this professional grade version to meet the requirements, but obviously there's not like a ton of astronauts right now, that it's not like a huge market, so we're also making a civilian grade version that's a one-to-one carbon copy. So the idea was to build something that is industry like professional grade, but also make it available for people like you and I that maybe we're not going to space anytime soon, but we can kind of live vicariously through that next chapter and really own like an actual space tool, which to me was always super cool. Like I remember looking on eBay and seeing like some flown equipment or
Tang, dude. This is better than Tang.
So something along those lines, even like, I don't know if you've ever seen those like space drills that they use. Yeah. They're just super cool. And it's like, man, I would love to work on my car with that. But obviously it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars and they're really hard to like access because it's like purely for astronauts. So I thought it would be cool to, while we're making this professional tool, also make a civilian version that's basically one-to-one so anyone could own like actual space hardware.
That's cool. So what's the pricing going to be and when's the availability? When's this going to drop?
So the pre-orders are available today. We just opened up the shop and it's $87.50 for the monolith. And right now, since it's still in pre-orders and we haven't like released all the features, it's 20% refundable deposit. So it's like $17.50 to like reserve a spot and be like, it's basically like first come, first serve for as we do deliveries. And we're planning on doing deliveries end of the summer. So like Q3 2024.
So when I had the prototype, you told me that the dial and handset was kind of really proto. So what's the face under that crystal going to look like or the handset?
Visually similar, but we're upgrading the type of loom, the nice. Overall finishes. We're working with RC Tritech, which does Swiss Superluminova. They're the gold standard. And with Black Badger too, he's been helping out
cool.
in the development. So we're kind of like, they've been helping like brainstorm. And it's fun because on one hand, it's like, it's easy to get, you know, crazy and make some wild dial, but it really will be a pretty simple, like very legible tool, like almost like an instrument dial. The one that you had is very similar to how the final one looks. It's more just like performance wise, like Sweet. How did improving the legibility, making the loom last longer, yeah. that sort of thing.
So cool. So black, it's going to be a black dial with applied indices yeah. with better loom, please. And yeah. The handset was kind of cool because basically you blacked out the center on the pinion side and it kind of looks like those hands just kind of float on the dial with whatever. I asked you if you used Vanta Black. You didn't, but like it's a it's a deep matte black, which is kind of cool. And yeah. then the Sweeping Seconds has the nice like orange nod, and I believe the tip was loomed, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And there's been some tweaks and improvements with the seconds hand, and like just general like weight balancing is also something that we had to think about just during impact. So yeah, we'll be doing like kind of this launch sequence where we're releasing these last couple features. Like we'll be talking in depth about the engine mount next, and then probably like the dial, the hands, and the strap will be kind of like the final stages before we reveal everything and then start doing deliveries.
That's awesome. When's deliveries going to happen?
Yeah, probably end of the summer. So like Q3 summer. 2024.
Dude, that's yeah. faster than some Kickstarters. So I want to rewind to where we started because I was going to hold on to it till the end. As you've said, this is not just a nod to space or an homage to space or daydreaming of space. Like we've established in two episodes now that you have built a space-ready watch. Is this going to go on an astronaut and when?
That's obviously something we're working towards.
You're not going to tell me more. Okay, fine. I tried, no, folks.
It's a good question. I think when, you know, this moon mission was a huge like first step for us getting some hardware up in space. Right now it's kind of like the spiritual aspect, so kind of this emotional connection to space where there's like now this lunar library that's preserved forever on the moon. Astronauts will be able to kind of like have this connection to the moon, but also this connection to home and everything that the content represents. On one hand side, it's like that's the first chapter, but this is obviously only the beginning of the journey. We want to keep getting the watch further and further, and you know, just sending watch or just sending the memory disk like we did for this mission is just the first step. And what will really like push the needle next is getting real world testing. We can test everything in analog environments here right. on Earth, and we can do a pretty good job. Nothing besides like microgravity is difficult to simulate, but everything else, I mean, temperatures and vacuums, there's lots of ground-based tests that can do that. But at the end of the day, like having real world feedback beyond just like meeting the requirements, but like, you know, how does it wear? How does it, like the tactile nature of it, handling it, maybe even servicing, like doing a test, like servicing in space with an actual astronaut. These are all things that we're wanting to work towards and get it on some actual astronauts.
Okay, Carell, you got it. There's going to be a third episode when it actually gets into space. Fine. Carell, thanks so much for coming up on the show.
Dude, thanks so much for having me.
Touchdown, the Eagle has landed on this episode of the Analog Explorer podcast. As you can tell, I had a blast hanging out with Carell. And hopefully this episode helps you understand a little bit more about the Monolith. Now, I had a very, very early beta of their watch, and I'm hoping that Carell will be able to hook me up with something a little bit closer to production, and I'll be able to chat about it more on Analog Explorer, either on the Substack or here on the show. Between now and then, though, be sure that you are subscribed to Barrelhand on Instagram, or if you want to sign up to join the mission, be sure you go to barrelhand.com/monolith. I'm AJ Barce, your Analog Explorer. I'm reminding you to make the time to explore on this planet or the next.